Welcome to Blind Shovel, an arts and music podcast. Today I had the pleasure of speaking with Mike Haldeman, sound sculptor and otherworldly guitarist. Hope you enjoy.
So where are you coming from today?
I drove here from Flatbush in Brooklyn, where I live with my partner and my dog. And
how long have you lived there?
I've lived in Flatbush for 7 years now, in a couple different places. But I've lived in New York for 12 years, but part of that was school. And then shortly after finishing school, moved to the neighborhood where I live now.
That's coming from Pennsylvania. Is that right?
Yep. Grew up in Coatesville, Pennsylvania.
Coatesville,
yeah.
Interesting.
Which was at one point the steel capital of the world, but the industry fell through the floor. And now Al Jazeera writes articles about the sort of issues that are going on with corruption and gerrymandering in the area and stuff like that. So it's interesting that this tiny little steel town in PA has become the focus of, you know, international news coverage in some ways, but otherwise it's kind of a sleepy place.
What was it like growing up there?
I traveled pretty far to go to school. I went to Quaker school, which was a big thing in Southeast PA, and went about 30 minutes away to go to school. And so I feel like most of my big experiences growing up were kind of like going to the nearest town, which was Westchester, Pennsylvania. It was kind of like the place where a lot of things were happening. And when I was a kid, it was the hero locally was Bam Margera. And if you're familiar with the TV show Viva La Bam at all, he was kind of like, he and his group of friends were, you know, kind of always up to some crazy local hijinks. And they had a skate shop and inspired a bunch of kids to break their limbs in new and interesting ways. And there was also like a really interesting like music scene around too, a lot of funny DIY shows that would happen in fun places, and yeah, we'd go into Philadelphia every now and then, but that was not as common a thing until I was like a teenager and felt comfortable taking, you know, over an hour long train ride into the city and back. So
were you influenced by Bam Margera or no?
I don't think so. I think I quickly moved through that phase after breaking my wrist on a bicycle.
Oh yeah.
And, you know, kind of very quickly recognized that I wanted to use my hands for things that I felt more precious about than extreme sports, and pretty quickly pivoted into focusing on music after that injury.
So were you always focused on music, or that happened after this traumatic?
I started taking music lessons from a family friend who was a piano teacher, probably around second grade. And I had a kind of frustrating time with it because I never really learned to read music.
And to this day?
To this day.
Okay.
I would not call myself literate in reading music, but I'm very, very slow at it. a lot of people are really good at what's called sight reading, which is basically being able to look at a piece of music and read it down. Dory, for example, is extremely good at that. I, on the other hand, would need a few days to familiarize myself with the page of music before feeling comfortable playing it.
And you have no interest in learning that.
I was lucky enough to find pretty far into my music education, actually, a handful of teachers who recognized that I was better at learning by ear than I was by reading sheet music. And they saw that in me and encouraged that and actually taught to that side of my learning capabilities instead of other music teachers who I had who declared me unteachable because I couldn't read music or otherwise didn't really know how to access me as a student.
Yeah.
Because I always loved music, but my relationship to learning it was like those first lessons sitting down at the piano with this family friend. I would never look at the music that was in front of us. I would watch the piano teacher's hands and then I would listen and I would, using my ears, sort of find my way back to the thing that I was being shown instead of referencing the sheet that was in front of me. And so she caught on to that pretty quickly and was like, hey, you need to actually practice this. And that pretty quickly became unfun for me. And so I stopped taking piano lessons and then moved on to clarinet and guitar around the same time. But then the clarinet teacher was one of the first people to tell me that I wasn't really teachable because I was struggling with reading music so much. But guitar teachers, on the other hand, were like, oh, we can absolutely encourage and grow this part of you. And you don't have to be able to read music to progress as a young guitarist right now. So
does that say something about guitars and clarinets?
I think the conventions surrounding those very different shapes of musical pedagogy are like really worlds apart.
Sure.
And especially the types of music that I was learning with my clarinet teacher was stuff that already has a long history of being a written, notated style of music. And I think guitar and the music that I was just generally more interested in tends to be not as much emphasizing that side of things. And so it was in one sense, it's like easier to learn the vernacular of an instrument without that whole background of all of the history of notation and everything that is used in a standardized way to like pass music along from generation to generation, you know? And so I think also there's just generally less, the approach to teaching guitar is a little more casual than the approach to teaching clarinet or other woodwinds.
Right. But there's cool kid instruments and there's not cool kid instruments.
Yeah. I mean, my friend Ian was playing guitar in third grade and I was like, that's the coolest thing I've ever seen. I want to be able to hang out.
Does he still play music?
I don't think so. I think he...
What stopped him, you think?
I'm not sure. I know for a fact that he makes way more money than me now. He's a mechanic on semi-trucks.
Oh, that's awesome.
And
that's pretty cool.
Lives a pretty good life, I'm pretty sure. So
good.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, you know, like, I can imagine he might romanticize what he would have been if he kept playing a guitar. Because for a lot of people who used to be interested in art or music, they almost had this, like, secret garden of that fantasy they keep.
Hmm.
I've talked to people, oh, I wish I was a painter, or like I still have a canvas in my attic just for that. And I'm just like, don't go up there.
Yeah.
Don't, like, it's clearly a fantasy. If it was something else, you would have done it. You would have gone to it. But it's probably pretty nice and bittersweet to imagine what it would be like. Because I don't know, do you feel the reality of being a musician is, it's probably to your liking, right?
I think it's a complicated landscape. I feel a massive amount of fulfillment from sitting down and creating new worlds and sound with people. whether it's improvising or writing music or, you know, sitting down and writing music to a prompt or to a film or to any kind of visual or something like that. That to me is a really stimulating practice, especially when it's with sensitive and generous collaborators. Like I've been playing a lot of solo shows recently, but that's kind of a scary place for me because I'm most comfortable, I think, like sitting in a group of people and having a sound conversation, so to speak, and like kind of sharing ideas and offering a gesture and seeing how that bounces off of the brains and instruments of people whose sounds and musical personalities really inspire me. That to me is a thing that if I could do that forever, I would absolutely feel unbelievably lucky to be able to do that. I think the reality of the way that musical practice gets deployed for a lot of people in society as a career is something that tends to muddy those waters a lot and oftentimes requires me as a musical performer to kind of, you know, mistake the forest for the trees a little bit and like not be able to settle into the beauty and spontaneity of those things that I love so much about making music with people in order to make enough money to survive in New York and pay rent and do the things that I like to do with my life. And I think that negotiation is complicated because there's a lot of music that I make for work that feels like I'm kind of putting on the suit and showing up and sitting at the desk and doing the job. But that's not that stuff. None of that is really the reason why I like to make music. I like to make music for all the things that I said a few minutes ago, like getting together with people who surprise and push me to make better sounds and be a better listener and a better collaborator and to have those learning experiences time and time again. I think that's another thing that's really big is like in the job context of this work, I think it is harder to have regular experiences where learning and actually running up against the limits of your capabilities is actually a good thing, I think.
Sure.
I think when it's a job, you're meant to do the job well. And that if you're experiencing that friction of like, wow, I'm really pushing myself to the limit of what I can do here, or I'm learning something actively in this process, that's maybe seen as unprofessional or something like that. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, because it implies a lack of knowledge at that moment.
Or like you're not prepared or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Most people pay for risk mitigation. They don't want to hear that.
Yeah.
Depends on the relationship of the employer. But also,
some people are really into improvised music, though.
Yeah.
And that is a thing that is all kind of discovery and risk-taking and kind of jumping with like a trust fall in front of an audience. And that to me...
That's what you prefer?
I really like playing improvised music. I think it is... I love playing the opposite of improvised music, too. Things that feel very structured and determined and like a well-crafted set is a joyful thing to put together. But for a completely different set of reasons than it is to like sit down with people you've never made sounds with before and see what happens.
What do you think your identity as a collaborator versus your identity alone is? Is it different?
I think the part of how do I put this? As a collaborator, the goal is to listen and observe and try to offer things that serve either a leader's vision or a collective vision. And that always kind of involves this like reflective moment where you kind of take in an environment or a group of people and you try to think about like kind of like a conversation. How am I going to say something that isn't like a random or upsetting or offensive thing in this conversation that also moves it along, that also kind of like helps everybody feel seen and appreciated and attended to as well. And especially, and that's even easier when everybody else is doing that to you as well. So I think as a collaborator, it's inherently about kind of reducing part of the ego and catering certain gestures and things that you're offering in a musical context to be things that speak to people.
But as an individual?
As an individual, it's like I spend most nights staying up kind of late, like experimenting with sound to just kind of see what new sounds I can find and what feels exciting, and kind of keeping my relationship with the instrument fresh and inspiring, and kind of building a library of places that I can go to sonically, because a lot of my practice is on the computer. That means that if I design a crazy sound, I can save it and log it away for like, that might be a thing that I use later.
Yeah.
Like if a painter were to be like, oh wow, I can't buy this specific tone of paint, but I mixed it at 2:30 a.m. This one night, I'm going to like mix myself a whole batch of this and like set it aside and maybe I'll use it later or something like that. But that process in large part is like driven by me wanting to see what new places I can go to. And I think there's a balance here between the collective and individual thing where if I give myself enough space to wander around and really stretch the limits of where I'm exploring by myself, I can first off come to the table with a much bigger library and vocabulary of sounds that may or may not work in certain contexts. But nevertheless, I've done kind of like my practice on my own to kind of like broaden my language and then come into a collaborative context with a lot more that I could possibly say. And I don't have to do as much of the like kind of flailing to find the right thing. And it becomes a little easier to feel like a fluent collaborator.
Yeah, because so the whole practice is in the service of, well, service, it seems to me. That some artists might be mining something, you know, like they might begrudgingly collaborate, but their real goal is to just get at the bottom of themselves, whatever that may mean, you know, and the collaboration's kind of in the way or at the service of that.
Yeah.
But yours sounds like you're sharpening your tool to better be in the service of or collaborate with others ultimately.
I think so. I think music for me is a shared thing.
Sure.
And I think that its core and its oldest versions are collective practices, and that there's something very ancient and like beautifully elongated through all of the dimensions of time and space that is like, this is the thing that people do together, and it only gets more powerful when more people are doing it together. And yeah, I think also in a time where so much, and since I'm a computer musician, a lot of computer music has become like a really solitary, lonely practice where people kind of like burrow into their laptop by themselves and, you know, still make beautiful things.
Sure.
But I feel like the trade-off for a lot of people into it with electronic music is like, that's a solitary, isolating type of direction to go. And it's fun for me to try to recontextualize those tools in a kind of like in a shared way, bringing it into a place where I can still use Ableton, but also be improvising with like four or five people together at the same time. That to me feels exciting and kind of like reorienting this thing that I think has put a lot of pressure on people to isolate in their creative processes.
Yeah.
In like the immediate sense, like the what the internet and online communities have done for electronic music has been like, it's blown open the doors and really expanded a lot of those boundaries for people. But also I think the actual practice of making the stuff when you're sitting down and creating sounds, that has overall become a much lonelier kind of practice.
Have you ever had a great musical connection with someone you don't have a great personal connection with? Is that possible?
I think it's possible. There are plenty of contexts in which people work together. Like I also work as an engineer and a mixer.
Mm.
And there can also be plenty of the flip side of what you're talking about, where you're like great friends with someone, mm-hmm. and you get together to try to make music together, and it's like it doesn't turn out as shiny as you would have expected it to, or something like
yeah.
that. But generally, a lot of those feelings are kind of self-critical projections that kind of fade away after a little bit of space from that moment anyway. And I find that I rarely feel as negative about stuff as I do like basically immediately after it happens. And then if I give myself a little time and space away from something, I'm generally like, oh, that wasn't that as bad as I thought it was or something. But I'm also my own worst critic.
Well,
mostly because of a lot of things that music teachers told me when I was really young to
kind of
implant a bunch of ideas in my head about not being good enough or something. Mm. So a lot of those voices are kind of constantly whirling around in there. But to answer your first question, I do think it is possible to have to make great music with people who you maybe, I don't know about making great music with people who you have an actively bad relationship with.
Yes.
But with people with whom the relationship hasn't really had the space to grow or develop, that can be a really exciting like context, I think. Like, I love getting together and playing with people who I've just met, or
yeah.
people who I'm getting to know, and like making music together is like part of the process of like learning about each other and also kind of deepening the relationship and jumping into a very like specific and kind of vulnerable and kind of like risky place together to see what happens. And I do appreciate that. And yeah.
No, I'm just curious because for me, I probably collaborate more than most visual artists, but mm-hmm. I usually need to have an actual connection.
Yeah.
First, probably. Although the collaborative cohesion is earned slowly. I don't know if it's as quick with music, you know?
Yeah.
Like you said, music is predicated on a certain collaborative spirit that a lot of fine art isn't, I don't think.
Yeah.
Maybe there were times, you know, but for instance, you build a church and there's like 100 different artists probably mm-hmm. doing their thing, but they're not really doing their thing together
yeah.
in that same way.
Yeah.
So I think there's probably many artists in their solitary lives who envy the collaborative and social nature of music, but I'm sure it's infuriating in other ways, you know, touring and having to deal with egos within a band.
Oh yeah. I mean, I love my bandmates and we are best friends. We have been best friends for over a decade, and many, many different twists and turns and ups and downs. And I know all of the sides of these people. And especially once you travel with folks mm-hmm. and commit to
making records together and like trying to form a unified voice in a musical offering or something like that, you really have to pour all your brains into the oatmeal together and see kind of like how it all separates, you know? And it's, I love getting that deep with people, but it also can't really happen with everybody, you know? There's kind of an emotional limit to how deep you can go with folks as collaborators, I think. And like, I'm really lucky to have best friends who I get to make albums with and who I get to tour with. And I think if my relationships were that deep with every single person I ever made music with,
yeah,
I don't know where I would have the mental energy left to like take care of myself or like remember to pay my bills or like love my dog or something like that and like be a good partner and like all yeah. and a good family member and all these things that are like, you know, part like the personal life dimensions that are outside of like all of the ways in which you invest yourself creatively into all of those relationships. So
does improv inspire a kind of egalitarian structure, or are there still clear hierarchies in within those kind of moments? You know, the reason I ask is like, I feel that maybe some of my favorite bands, and I'm trying to think of some like Talking Heads or even the Strokes, like there seems, and slowly through time, at least in certain instances, you understand the structure of a band, usually when it falls apart.
Yeah.
But like, there's just one person who's kind of tyrannical doing everything and then not forcing, but delegating out like what they wrote or something.
Yeah.
And then like, I don't know if you even care about the Strokes, but.
Oh, I know the story.
The trajectory is interesting. Whenever he gives more, Julian Casablancas gives more control to the other members, the music seems to, it seems like he's appeasing them, but the music suffers, even though I like later Strokes stuff. Do you think, because I often say, like, visual art doesn't work with democracies, you know, like everyone voting if this graphic design element should be here or here. But can you speak to that dynamic of like, yeah, that, I don't know what the opposite
the power,
is.
The power dynamics there. Right. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot in this question.
Sure.
There's, especially in the realms of improvised music, I think like the ways recently that people have become more aware of, like the dynamics of identity and intersectionality and the ways that certain types of people's representation in these worlds, especially in jazz, which in New York, there's a really enormous, important conversation taking place right now about women in improvised music and the dynamics around specifically jazz jam sessions and jazz programs and music conservatories in general.
Contemporary?
Yes. And how a lot of the power dynamics in those environments are really, really messed up. And so people who are tuned into those conversations are making themselves more aware of who tends to take up more space in certain spaces and
musically and
peripherally? just like as a like the power that society endows certain people with. And like that's one whole dimension of this. That's really, really deep. And I don't know if I have the time to really go into all of that, but in my personal experience, like I think the biggest thing is just kind of being a sensitive listener and like trying to, in the same way that being a good conversationalist means leaving space for someone to say their piece or say as much as they want to say, even if it's not saying much, you know, at least being aware, looking at a person and trying to intuit where they're at and leaving air so that not the very first thing that I'm doing is like kind of jumping down someone's throat or stepping on their toes. I, especially me as someone who kind of loves big, like kind of stark musical gestures, a thing that I've had to learn recently as an improviser and a collaborator is to kind of like reel those back a little bit, because some of those sounds and some of those gestures can take up a lot of space. And it means that it doesn't leave a lot of room for other people to say what they would want. And that is something I've been working on. And especially because I love to try to make the guitar sound as unfamiliar as possible. Mm. And that oftentimes involves like turning a bunch of different parameters up to 13 and just seeing what the hell comes out of the instrument, which most of the time when I'm in that zone, some really crazy sounding shit comes out. And that isn't always the most tactful gesture in a musical conversation. It can kind of be like walking up to a quiet chat that's happening and like just yelling out of nowhere. And, you know, in some environments that might be welcomed, but in a lot of spaces that can kind of be an overwhelming shape of things to introduce into a context. So that's at least my personal piece about that. And I think like there are hierarchies that also emerge due to people's strengths and predilections.
Yeah.
In collaborative contexts, like someone who is a percussionist is going to inherently care more about like certain types of rhythm, or if you're playing with a group where there is a drummer and a bassist, there's going to be a specific connection between the drums and the bass that doesn't extend to the rest of the group.
Right.
And there's going to be these kind of like an array of different relationships that extend throughout the room that I might be listening to a drummer in a certain way that no one else in the room is, or I might be listening to a trombonist in a way that the drummer isn't listening to them that way, or something like that. So there are all of these different modes to kind of like try to switch through in order to like try to hear and respond to the things that are being articulated together. And I think what gets really fun is if you're really on the same page with people, you can really play with those power dynamics a lot, and you can really trust someone to kind of blast off into a really confident and clear direction, and you can kind of like pop your toe line onto that and like water ski behind them for a little bit. Mm. And then they can slingshot you in front, and then you're the one who's kind of like leading the direction. And like that to me is the most exciting place, where there's like where everybody can intuit together when they're going to like take charge and when they're going to like cede responsibility to other people. And it doesn't have to be like necessarily like, hey, I want you to lead now, but it's kind of implied.
Yeah.
And people know when to step up and take charge in that sort of way.
You know, I don't know a lot about jazz, but it strikes me as...
I don't know much about jazz.
You don't either?
No.
No, but it's interesting to me as you describe it, like, and the nature of jazz, and then the fact that there's these jazz musicians that are like giants, you know, like
planets,
and seem from little I've seen of, because I like watching videos of just like jazz musicians looking at each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's like some real egos at play, if not some of the biggest.
Oh yeah,
and it's very interesting to consider these little. I think of them as like little governments or something. Each band's they're little companies, I guess.
Yeah.
But do you, because I think about it from filmmaking as well, right? So there's like filmmakers who are going to, the director's going to let you do your thing with their script. And then there's great ones who are just like, nope, this is exactly what it is.
Right. Don't change my vision. Yeah.
And I suppose there's musicians who like that too.
Yeah.
Who want to be in that position.
Yeah.
But have you ever been more in that position where it's like, because it doesn't sound like someone could tell you to do that based on your skill set. and the fact that you aren't necessarily going to like read their sheet of music, it kind of protects right. you in a good way, I think.
I, for a while, years ago, most work that I would get as a guitar player in New York City was to kind of put on the costume of guitar player and do all the things that are typically expected of guitar players to do. And I found this kind of frustrating because I have a messy relationship with the sound that the instrument makes on its own, which is why I try to kind of push it into really unfamiliar directions and sounds and things like that. And so when someone would hire me to be a guitarist for like a New Year's party,
oh yeah,
and I would have to show up and learn a book of 75 top 40 songs and kind of do the top 40 guitarist thing,
yeah,
that felt very much like putting on a Halloween costume in a not fun sort of way.
Sure. And, but, and it also clarifies something for me. You can do that easily.
Not that easily. Not as easily anymore. At that point, it wasn't terribly difficult, but it wasn't pleasant.
Okay.
It felt like trying to do something that didn't feel real or authentic or exciting to me. And more recently, I think especially once I've started doing solo performances and people have been able to see more regularly what I kind of do when I'm left to my own devices, that has led to a really exciting chain reaction where people have been asking me way more often to just come into a context and do whatever I want to do. And I feel really, really lucky to be in that position. There were many years of it not being like that. So I'm also like really happy to be in this newer shape of things, because I think if the foundations of my career were built on the type of work that I was doing years ago, I would not be a very happy musician right now. I would feel like it's hard for me to be being asked to make sounds that don't feel honest all the time would be hard to do. And now a lot of the work feels really open-ended and kind of like, I love what you do. Do whatever you want here.
Right.
And that can be really freeing, but also a little bit overwhelming. Because sometimes some like direction and like a starting point is like a really helpful thing. So some of my favorite collaborators, and also my bandmates, are really good at this because they know me really well, know how to provide like just the right amount of direction or like a query or a starting point to kind of open up an exploration, which usually starting from a seed is easier than starting from
a vacuum.
Yeah, do whatever you would want to
First of all, whenever anyone says that, they have subconscious expectations.
That's also
so they're not articulating what they actually want, and then they see something and they react and then they realize, oh, I actually did have probably a clear expectation.
Yeah.
But I'm curious to know more about this messy relationship with the guitar and its sounds that it produces, because I think I understand even in the sense. Like, I don't listen to Jimi Hendrix much, but I respect him. Mm-hmm. But they're, with a lot of instruments, they over time have like cartoonish natures. Like, he's wailing on it like that. And like Guy in Guitar Center is doing that.
Yeah, there's these caricatures and
that emerge.
Like, yeah. And stereotypes and things like that. So it's not as much, it's in part about that, because I think. For a long time growing up, I really idolized a very specific type of guitar player, which it's the sound of someone who really loves the sound of their instrument. This is the easiest way I can describe it. Someone who can just pick up a guitar and play it and like already be in love with the sounds that are coming out of it. For me, as a self-critical person and a person who is really obsessed with being surprised, I find it very difficult to pick up a guitar
and feel immediately inspired by the sound that it makes by itself with me attached to it. That usually feels like it's lacking an element of surprise, or it's lacking an element of like, whoa, where am I going here? Or I like to kind of feel
conversation.
I like to feel like whisked away by a sound or an instrument or a process or something like that. Something that I can honestly like lose touch with all of the other stuff that's on my mind. Mm. That it feels exciting and surprising enough that it's going to like make me forget to make myself dinner, or you know, like that. That's kind of the stuff that is the gas in my engine, so to speak. Like, and so I've talked to a bunch of friends about this, but maybe the person who I've connected the most with this about is my friend Darian, who's a really, really talented composer and violinist. And we've played in a lot of different contexts in the last few years after we met, but we were talking about this kind of shared feeling we have about this messy relationship with our instruments. And he feels very similarly about violin, which is that like, there's almost like a sort of instrumental dysphoria where the sound in my head that I want to make, that I want to make real through this instrument, it's very hard for that instrument to make it by itself. So in the same ways that people take normal sounding instruments and really push them to their limits to try to find where their voice is on that instrument.
Yeah.
Like Hendrix is a great example of this, like taking the guitar to a place that is like beyond where people had dreamt that it could go. And that was his voice. I think my voice on the instrument isn't something that's easy to access when it's just a guitar plugged into an amplifier with nothing else going
on. Or an acoustic.
The relationship has gotten even more complicated because I've actually been really enjoying playing acoustic guitar recently, but I think it's been mostly about preparing the instrument so that it sounds different, like sticking a bunch of foam under the strings or like putting it in a crazy tuning or messing around.
I'm thinking about Korn, strangely enough. That relation, that weird rattly,
yeah,
I don't know if that was bass or guitar, but.
Oh, yes, it's all bass and guitar.
Well, that's something funny about love that it's tied to ambivalence in some sense, right? Like, mm-hmm. I don't know if this is like just because we crave novelty over tradition in some sense, but the people who are pioneers of the last 100 years often in some ways really don't like whatever that thing is that they're pursuing. Like Geary in architecture, like he hung out with abstract painters and mm-hmm. you can see that. And I'm often confused because I would imagine traditionalists are more like they're trying to carry a specific torch and then refine it a little.
Yeah.
But to see a guitar, because is it fair to say, would you ever get to a place where you said, well, I just made a sound that doesn't feel like it came from a guitar, but from like a keyboard, and that's a problem or something?
I think for me, it's exciting because there's like an element of translation happening there. And I think what happens when you force something through a filter or a process of translation to make it into something else, that transformation, a lot gets lost and a lot gets added. And I think that's kind of the kernel of like the exciting element for me, is like when you force something through a bottleneck, how is it different on the other side? And so I kind of like using equipment that isn't like professional standard. Like I love using bad guitar pedals that cost like $25 that have a really specific character, but don't maintain some sort of purity of the sound. It's not like an open gate that the sound passes smoothly through. It's like it kind of comes through the other side of it a little shredded up. And that, that to me is an exciting thing to incorporate into my practice, and like also kind of gets at what things I want to express through the instrument. It's almost as though the sounds that come out the other end are meant to say, wow, this person, can only use this instrument in a way that leads to these sort of surprising outcomes, like where there's an inevitability to that because of all of those little moments of translation that happen along the signal chain. Or like oftentimes I'll record a bunch of my playing and then it's not even about what I played in that moment. It's about taking that audio and then working on it even more to sort of defamiliarize it from the place that it was at.
So does it matter that it's made via a guitar? Is that important? Does it matter if it's six strings? Would you take up a 12 string? Would you play a bass? Or is the guitar the foundation of the thing that needs to be preserved in some ways?
I think because that's the instrument that I'm most fluent on, that's an important part of the process. Like that first step of translation feels like it needs to be, like I'm still a proficient guitar player, but I don't feel as like comfortable just like picking up a guitar and playing a solo guitar show in front of a bunch of folks. Like that to me feels really scary and naked and not like who I am. But there is something exciting about sitting down at a really unfamiliar instrument too, and kind of seeing what happens and trying to like force my voice through something that I have no idea how to play. It's hard when it's a thing like a flute or an oboe that requires a really specific technique that does need nurturing. But also I think like some of my favorite music is made by people who have like non-standard relationships with their instruments from a pedagogical perspective, like are not experts. Like, do you know the band Half Japanese? Have you heard of Half Japanese before?
I don't think so.
It is some of my favorite music ever. And it is made by people who, for all intents and purposes, like from a academic perspective, have no idea what's going on with their instruments. But from the perspective of someone who like loves what they're doing, they're extremely fluent despite having no formal training, and pick up a guitar and make extremely compelling sounds regardless of whether they know what the names of the notes are on the fretboard or even have the guitar in a consistent tuning from show to show or things like that. Like Jad Fair, one of the band members of Half Japanese, literally keeps a guitar with the neck practically falling off of it so that he can like bend the guitar in half to make these like crazy sounds. And so I don't think it is always about using the thing that you're best at. But I think for me personally, where I'm at right now is that guitar is the way that it's the fastest way for me to get from the idea in my head to sound in the world. And so that's kind of the main color palette right now that I pull from.
But I assume throughout your whole life, the guitar is pretty consistent. It's the thing that attracted you initially?
Yes.
As a child?
Yeah, I mean, piano was first, and then recorder, and then guitar and clarinet around the same time. And then clarinet was put down for about 10 years, and then I picked it up again a couple of years ago. So
was your identity as a child a musician?
No.
Not at all?
I don't think I decided that I wanted to do music for life until I was maybe 17 or 18 years old.
I do find that this is common with people who make more unique art in some sense. They're less hung up on these Well, I call the drawer's hang up. Like, if you drew when you were like 3 and everyone's like, you're really good at that,
mm-hmm.
you tend to have, and this is not a bad thing per se, you tend to have expectations about how well you can draw.
Yes.
And less so than making a compelling image. Mm-hmm. And some people get caught up in that their whole life. So they're just trying to draw well and they probably make bad images. But people who start looking at art or music more seriously in high school probably have a more conceptual, because they have a developed relationship to it mentally. It's just mm-hmm. a different time period in your life. And so they're very different approaches, but I am interested in when people get attached to the identity, because it usually has a different repercussions in respect to what they seek to do with it.
I think I fell in love with music around the time that I decided that I wasn't going to music school. I think the most loving thing I did for myself as a musician today was decide to not go to music school. I think those decisions wouldn't have happened together I may have made the decision to go to music school. And I think even if that had been confidently made, there would be a kind of embedded questioning in that decision, which is like, well, I could still flunk out of music school.
Mm-hmm.
And then what does that mean for, am I a failed musician?
Yeah, is that over? Point?
Like all the neuroses as like a teenager thinking about wanting to have a career in that.
But you did go to school.
I did go to school.
For?
I was in a program at NYU called Gallatin that is like a design your own major sort of program.
Your own major.
Yeah. So if there was a question I was trying to answer throughout college, it is, what are we talking about when we're talking about creativity? Which
you mean, yeah, because the word is very
extremely vague and historically many different meanings and a lot of different, it's a big onion, and the onion only got bigger in college. I left with more questions than answers. So, but I had a lot of fun. I really love school, and like I was a teacher's pet in high school, and like had a lot of good friends who were professors as like a high school student, and loved my college professors. And there was a while where I thought I might go to grad school and kind of stay in that world for a while. But I wound up meeting my best friends who are also my bandmates when I was a sophomore, and they kind of quickly whisked me into a lot of musical situations that slowly like made it a major priority in my life to do that. And I think without it was really two factors. It was the combination of deciding to not go to music school and then meeting these best friends of mine that kind of like solidified for me that music was going to be an important planet in my universe for the rest of my life.
And at that time you formed Alto Palo?
Yes.
That was the name of the band. It's still the name of the band.
Well, at first when we were first playing together, we were hired by a bunch of people to kind of be a band for hire, because we were a guitarist, a bassist, a drummer, and a keyboard player. Mm-hmm. And, you know, also best friends, no funny vibes in those days. And like, it was really easy to get all of us together, and we had a good thing going, really easy to like gel and be inside of our own, each other's heads and like have a lot of fun. And I think people saw that and asked us to be their band pretty often. And we didn't really start making original music until a little more than like a year into our friendship. And at first we called ourselves Alt Disney, which was a name we quickly abandoned because, you know, can't really broadcast that much without risking a lawsuit.
Not with Disney, no.
Yeah. And then we settled on Alto Palo, and we've been Alto Palo since then.
Which has some relationship to Palo Alto.
None of us are from there. We just literally liked the way that the word sounded.
Okay.
And we were like, that's nice. It was a whole endeavor to try to decide a band name, and I'm I'm glad we still like this one, because there were a lot of other ones flying around that could have been not so great in the long term. But I'm
Is there some kind of, I imagine it's hard to be in a band that long, and well, you have to mature together, I would suspect. You know, like you couldn't spin off into your own lives without jeopardizing that project. Is that accurate?
I mean, everybody works a lot in a lot of different contexts, and the years have certainly ebbed and flowed in the amounts of time that we're all around each other. And like, there was a period of time during 2020 where the band took a break, and we were doing a lot of self-analysis and kind of like breaking down some of the internal neuroses and power dynamics and things that had been taken for granted for a really long time that had become unhealthy little friendship gremlins that needed to be exercised. Mm-hmm. And after all of that, like, it's not like those gremlins go away as much as like new things get added to the story. Like, it's hard to change, like, we know each other so well, and it's hard to really obliterate past versions of ourselves. And like, because at this point in my life, like, I have so few friends who I've kept for longer than 10 years, you know. Yeah. And like, especially living in a place like New York where so many people are coming in and leaving, and like, you stay in touch with people and lose touch with people, and I only have a handful of friends from high school and before then that I still remain close with. And so at this point, these guys are among my longest held friends, aside from like my own family, you know. And we're all just so deep inside of each other's like predilections and neuroses and all of that. It's like hilarious, because in a lot of ways we can predict each other's moves and also finish each other's sentences, whether that's like in life or in music. And that has its pitfalls and its benefits, of course. And it's a long and complicated story. And I think the thing that is underneath all of it is a feeling of deep, deep siblinghood. Mm. More than anything else, it's like, we've, in the band, there are two older siblings and two younger siblings. Like, myself and my bandmate Dylan, we both have younger sisters, and Jesse and Rom both have older brothers. And we kind of like this, we found that like, looking at the things that make us specific in the ways that we all relate to each other are honestly like pretty intimately tied to family dynamics and like, mm-hmm. and sibling dynamics, especially like, because we're all so close in age, and like all of the things that feel like brotherly siblingish competition and rivalry and jealousy and emotional interwovenness is all, it feels all really of the same fabric. And so that's kind of one of the metaphors that we use often in kind of like diagnosing our all the funny things that happen between us, is like usually looking at the siblingishness of all of it is the fastest way to get to the bottom of the beanstalk there.
Yeah. And they all live in New York City?
Yeah, we're all in the same couple of neighborhoods.
Gotcha.
And we share a studio, and yeah, we're about to go on tour for the first time since 2019, which is really exciting and also really scary. I haven't traveled for more than a couple weeks in 3 years, so
And that's for the album that Neve did the cover on?
Yeah, it's for
that.
What's
that one called again?
It's called Frenemy.
Right.
And it's actually an album about our friendship, which we didn't really make it as a way to like exorcise demons as much as it was a way to name them and make peace with them. And
you're drawing the distinction because exorcism removes something?
Yeah, or it banishes it.
It's, and like, this is just chilling there?
Well, yeah, like I said, like the inner layers of the onion aren't going anywhere. There's just, the onion gets bigger as time goes on. And this band just happens to be one of the biggest onions in my life right now. And
so you got a lot of onions.
Got a lot of onions. And I feel very blessed to be living an onion-full life.
Do you like onions or no?
You know, I've really come around recently.
They're great.
My bandmates all used to really rag on me because I really didn't like onions for a long time. And raw or cooked just wasn't down. Onion rings are still kind of hard for me.
Really?
But more recently, onions and vinegar. I'm having a big turnaround with all those things. They're really bright and spiky, and acidic foods are doing things for me right now.
Nice.
Pickled onions are really, really the shit.
I don't know if I've had that.
Pickled red onion? The ones that like turn bright pink?
Yeah. Is it hard to have clear objectives and goals for a whole band when you're looking forward here? Because like, how many albums do you have now?
We have four or five. It kind of depends on how you count them.
Okay. How many car commercials have you done?
Zero.
No, I'm just thinking, joking about the metrics of success.
Our greatest metric success is being on the Spotify Mellow Mood playlist, which is...
Was it helpful?
It's definitely helpful. It's where all of our monthly listeners come from.
Right, that's cool.
And otherwise, if we weren't on that playlist, we would be in the metrics department, a much smaller band. But, you know... we're still big in our hearts. That's the reality of things. But yeah, the long-term goals dimension of stuff is definitely a complex negotiation, because I think we all have different ideas of what a healthy and sustainable creative life looks like. And not to say that they don't overlap, but the Venn diagram is pretty vast. And I think the amount of time that we all spend in the same part of the Venn diagram oscillates, and it can be, I think the easiest way to sync up is to be working together on a specific thing all at the same time. I think the times that it gets really flaily is like, an album gets finished and then we turn it over to all of the other mechanical processes that lead to it showing up on Spotify or wherever.
Sure.
And that can take anywhere between like 6 months and a year for it to actually come out. And that period of time, while you're waiting for the music to come out, and it's like, you're kind of sizing up how it's performing when each single is released, is that can be particularly rough for keeping everybody's like,
I'm sure,
head on the same level. And but touring or working on new music can actually be really exciting, because the goal is to kind of move together. And that's honestly a thing that we're really good at, is like setting up and playing a show and being one organism. And that is when things feel the most locked in. I don't think it's any coincidence, because we all love performing.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that the Venn diagram like strongly overlaps for all of us. We love playing shows. We love traveling. We love watching an audience react to us making a bunch of freaky noise in front of them. That's like a really fulfilling thing for each of us. And so that tends to be the part of working together that feels the most like flying,
And yeah, I've had brief moments. I used to play bass, and that feeling of, I don't know, you start smiling and laughing. At least that was my experience. And that was enough for me.
Yeah.
I just stopped.
Or you kind of like lose track of the kind of boundaries between people.
Yeah, it's weird.
And the stuff that makes you so different from everybody else kind of dissolves, and you can kind of all meld into a mush together. And that feels, that's like the home feeling that, mm-hmm. you know, family in its best shapes can provide, and also like best friendships and falling in love and all of that has that in common in some sort of way. It's kind of like the edges disappear and everybody's bits are mixing together in new and exciting ways.
And you said you went to a Quaker school?
I did.
I'm interested in Quakerism.
Quakerism is really cool.
Yeah, it seems fascinating.
I think, like, you know, that there's plenty of examples of like shit getting weird and culty.
Sure.
And that's worth mentioning. But I think overall, Quakers have a really cool vibe. I love meeting for worship is just like a really interesting structure, that there's like no leadership and no preacher, no one telling you how to think. It's like, are you familiar with the structure?
I watched a video about it.
Also, meeting houses are just like architecturally really interesting spaces where everybody sits down facing each other. And once you feel moved to speak, you stand up and speak your mind. You can do whatever you want. You can dance. You can play a song. You can talk. It's a totally open-ended context where anybody who feels moved to share is allowed to stand up and share.
Yeah, I can't help but feel that that's influential to your process. Sounds similar. This like kind of open, sharing, and
I think the quietness dimension is something that I'm trying to come back to more, like with what I said earlier about like trying to be more mindful about how like really large sonic and musical gestures can feel a bit like steamrolling to other people I'm like collaborating with sometimes, and so that aspect of like reading the room or like trying to intuit someone's musical personality and not bulldoze them.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like a helpful thing is reminding myself of the meeting for worship environment where it's literally like in some cases, hundreds of people sitting in a room together, being completely silent, just waiting for the right inspiration.
Yeah.
It's kind of like improv religion. Because the idea in there is that the creative act, standing up and speaking your mind, is a thing that God is telling you to do.
Sure.
But it doesn't have to be God influencing that. It can just be a thing that comes into your mind and you're like, this feels important to share, and you stand up and share it. And that doesn't feel too far off from improvisation.
No, yeah. You know? Sounds like that's the origin, loosely. I hope to experience it one day. I don't know if it's open to non-Quakes.
Yeah, you can absolutely show up to a Quaker meeting as a non-community member. A lot of them, the doors are really open. And I mean, the other tenet of Quakerism is that the idea of God isn't like a concentrated, singular being, like an old dude in the sky or something like that. God is... The saying is there's that of God in everyone and everything. And so godliness is like a substance that is evenly distributed throughout the universe.
Mm.
Like there is as much God in my pinky toe as there is in a splinter of wood the size of my pinky toe over across.
As long as they're the same size.
Yeah, exactly. It's
scale
all
issue.
Yeah, and density, you know, everything. You know.
Well, we have to do sound check.
Oh.
You want to explain that real quick? We're doing tonight?
Oh, tonight, Michael was kind enough to invite me to live score Fritz Lang's Metropolis, which is a really stunning work of early science fiction. I think it came out in 1927.
I believe that's correct, yeah.
Almost 100 years, like 95 years ago. That's crazy to me.
Probably shown in that theater, because that theater was built in 1922.
Yeah.
That's, yeah.
I hope it was. And you know, it's a funny movie that is like regarded as being hugely, hugely influential, and people have like mixed critical opinions about it because it's like, you know, maybe not Fritz Lang's best film, but it is like there's so many things like infused in this film that have like influenced the genre of sci-fi forever since then, even like horror and suspense as well. Like all of the things when you think like Dr. Frankenstein, like literally all the tropes of like the mad scientist were literally lifted from this film. And like the inventor in this movie is like one of the first archetypes of like that character to ever exist, with like the deformed hand and the crazy hair and like all the scientific electronic experiments going on everywhere. Yeah, it's like, and so I get the honor of live scoring this massively influential film and doing it in a very cool space. So I'm excited about that.
Yeah, I appreciate you doing that. All right, let's get at that sound check.
Yeah.
And maybe people will be able to listen to it if it, you know, gets out there one day.
Yeah.
Bootlegs.
Oh, I'm gonna record it. That's for sure.
And the beat goes on. Music by Dori Bavarsky and Ming-Ji Chen. Next week we have Spark Studio out of Portugal.